So a lot of my work uses the Chicago landscape as a medium, as a whole way to engage individuals about large systemic issues. So I'm still trying to figure out what does that make me, but I am a photographer and a multimedia artist. And I am born and raised in Chicago from my home neighborhood of Englewood on the south side of Chicago. My project that kind of catapulted me into the public eye of Chicago is a project called Folded Map. And what I like to tell people is that even though it's a project that's multimedia that includes photos, portraits, large-scale Chicago map, video, it's really my biography in a project. All of my projects are rooted in my experience as a lifelong Chicagoan, and all of my projects are about digging deeper into the history of my home neighborhood, Greater Englewood, because I truly feel the more that I understand about my home neighborhood, it helps me understand all of Chicago. And understanding Chicago and its history with systemic racism and discriminatory housing practices really is the perfect case study to understand the rest of the country. So I never explain this project the same each time because it has so many layers. But how I like to tell people who are not Chicagoans is, first, Chicago is laid out on a beautiful, unique, rectangular grid. And so my project uses Chicago's grid map as a way to help people understand that these corresponding addresses that exist in racially and economically different neighborhoods are basically on the same street. And so the project Folded Map literally folds Chicago's map at its midway point to have neighborhoods that are segregated from each other touch each other by having residents who live in those segregated neighborhoods meet each other and have a conversation. And so that's the concept. The conceptual folding is having these neighbors who I refer to as map twins, who are literally 15, 18 miles apart sometimes, to come together to have a conversation. It's really to help people understand that oftentimes all of these systemic issues can seem so overwhelming and large, and it's very blatant in Chicago, the racial segregation, and people don't know ways to disrupt it. And a lot of times we tend to think that only legislation, voting for our elected officials, we tend to get trapped into thinking that's the only way that can really make some concrete difference in changing the way that segregation has impacted us. And so all of my work, leading with Folded Map, is really to help people know that it's as simple as using the segregation as a tool to disrupt it. We know it's there. We know it exists. We know we have neighborhoods that are racially and economically different. Go visit them. When you meet people that are from there and you happen to like them, go visit them. Accept the invitation. Learn about each other's neighborhood. And the more you know about other neighborhoods, the more you begin to understand how people feel, how people view their neighborhood, their city. And it just creates a pathway for people to question and challenge stereotypes that segregation allows us to formulate. The first MAPS twins, Wade, Nanette, and Jennifer. Wade and Jennifer are the Northside MAP twins. They're an interracial couple. Wade is an older white male. Jennifer is an older Asian woman. And Nanette is an older Black woman. They were my first MAP twins. And they met each other in early 2017. And, I mean, they're practically family now. They celebrated Wade's recent birthday at Nanette's new business that she started. They started a group called Inglewood Renaissance, where they actually expanded my project and created Block Twins. They introduced their neighbors to each other. So, yeah, they've been very close friends since they met. And that was in 2017. My following project after Folded Map, which is called Belonging, it included portraits and audio stories of Black and brown teenagers in Chicago discussing the neighborhoods where they feel like they don't belong and what they do to create a sense of belonging. And each project was ultimately for public education. I had close artist friends who I call like my kitchen cabinet of advisors. They suggested that I formalize my project into a nonprofit as a way for me to continue to do my passion full time. And so that's what I decided to do. It was primarily set up as a business structure, so I could qualify for different grant opportunities and be paid to continue to do work that I was ultimately just doing anyway for free. But since then, it's evolved into a nonprofit that actually serves as a fiscal sponsor for another initiative that's close to my heart, which is the Inglewood Arts Collective. I recently partnered with Chicago Bungalow Association so we can do an expansion of my current project. And being a nonprofit has enabled me to get funding to expand my projects very concrete ways that can contribute to the people I co-create my projects with. It's allowed me to receive funding to actually help residents who live on a block that was included in one of my projects to get home repairs. So it's really a way for me to receive grant funding to make a larger impact with my projects in a more concrete way. That's what's most concrete for me, is engaging with people, introducing them to my work, hosting activities or workshops, and seeing the light bulb go off and seeing people feel affirmed, seeing people feel comfortable enough to ask questions that might seem dumb or potentially offensive, but we haven't had an opportunity to ask each other these questions. and I was fortunate enough to be able to do that at a young age, and I want to offer that to people. So that's what's most concrete, and that's the one of the ultimate goals, is just to provide tools for people to facilitate these very awkward conversations around race, stereotypes, and segregation. So my Inequity for Sale project is similar to Folded Map. It's going to be a lifelong ongoing project. But what it is a project where I create actual landmarkers for a collection of homes in Greater Inglewood that were legally stolen from aspiring Black homeowners through the discriminatory housing practice of land sale contracts. So people have become more familiar with the term redlining, which is how we got segregated. But land sale contracts was a tool that was used once people were segregated. Once Black people were segregated into certain neighborhoods, it was used to ensure they didn't get home ownership. And so my project creates landmarkers for just 13 of those nearly 600 documented homes in Greater Englewood that were legally stolen from aspiring Black homeowners. So some of the landmarkers include the fact that the city of Chicago's land bank owns the property. And the overall intention of the project was to help people understand that this history is not far from our lives. It's literally amongst us. And it is the reason that specific neighborhoods in Chicago are struggling with low home ownership, high crime rate, high school closures. It is the exact reason. This is the reason that our neighborhoods are struggling. It's because of racist housing policy. And it's not a distant past at all. And it's the reason that we have so many abandoned homes, so many vacant lots, because a lot of the homes that were legally stolen became devalued and are vacant now. And so as an expansion of my Inequity for Sale project, I partnered with Chicago Bungalow Association, who is an amazing nonprofit that provides free energy efficiency programs to Chicagoans. But the issue is that sometimes in disinvested Black neighborhoods, in order to access this free program, you have to have a strong roof. You have to have a solid home. And that's exactly what people in my home neighborhood are struggling with. So through this partnership with CBA, we're providing home repairs and retrofits to the residents on the block. So that's what the expansion of Inequity for Sale is doing. And that project is called Unblocked. And it's a play on the term that it is on one block. And these people had a lot of barriers in their way to remain homeowners that are directly connected to these historic racist housing practices. So I was invited to Paris to expand one of my projects, and I chose to expand my project Belonging. And so the France version of my Belonging project is I actually interviewed and photographed Black French people about their relationship with their country and if they feel like they belong in their own country. And so while I was there for 2 months, the unfortunate incident of an Algerian teenager being shot by the police that occurred. And it really kind of heightened the urgency and importance of having those conversations, because in France, they don't use race. They don't go by race. The perception is that they don't have racial issues because they don't even use those words because everybody's French, right? But the experiences there don't line up with that ideal perception they want the rest of the world to have. And so really what I learned in expanding that project there was them not having, French people not having the language to distinguish race or national heritage of different families prevents them from being able to get statistics that kind of prove what people of color who are French experience. So it's a massive erasure of what people of color who are French, and specifically French people of African descent, what they go through. And so my Belonging project really offered a platform for some of them to share their feelings about that. And so I'm still working on editing the audio and editing the remaining portraits. But yeah, it was a wonderful, eye-opening experience, for sure.
Mike Tyson comes from Brooklyn, and so do I. Where he grew up was about a 20-minute bus ride from my house. I always thought his neighborhood looked like a war zone. It reminded me of Berlin immediately after World War II. I had never seen Berlin except for black and white photos in Life magazine, but that was bad enough. Rubble, barren, blasted. Everywhere you turned your eyes recoiled from the jagged edges of an office building or a cathedral shattered, or the tops of apartment houses torn off, and nothing alive even intimated anywhere. I used to think, this is what it means to fight and really win or really lose. War means you hurt somebody or something until there's nothing soft or sensible left. For sure, I never had a boyfriend who came out of Mike Tyson's territory. Yes, I enjoyed my share of tough guys and or gang members who walked and talked and fought and loved in quintessential Brooklyn ways, cool, tough, and deadly serious. But there was a code as rigid and as romantic as anything that ever made the pages of traditional English literature. A guy would beat up another guy, or if appropriate, he'd kill him. But a guy talked different to a girl. A guy made other guys clean up their language around his girl. A guy brought ribbons and candies and earrings and tulips to a girl. He took care of her. He walked her home. And if he got serious about that girl, and even if she was only 12 years old, then she became his lady. And woe betide any other guy stupid enough to disrespect that particular young black female. But none of the boys, none of the young men, none of the young black male inhabitants of my universe and my heart ever came from Mike Tyson's streets or avenues. We didn't live somewhere fancy or middle class, but at least there were 10-cent gardens front and back, and coin laundromats, and grocery stores, and soda parlors, and barbershops, and holy roller church fronts, and chicken shacks, and dry cleaners, and bars and grills, and a takeout Chinese restaurant, and all of that usable detail that does not survive a war. That kind of seasonal green turf and daily life supporting pattern of establishments to meet your needs did not exist inside the gelid urban cemetery where Mike Tyson learned what he thought he needed to know. I remember when the city of New York decided to construct a senior housing project there in the childhood world of former heavyweight boxing champion Mike Tyson. I remember wondering, where in the hell will those old people have to go in order to find food? And how will they get there? I'm talking godforsaken. And much of living in Brooklyn was like that. But then it might rain or it might snow. And for example, I could look at the rain forcing forsythia into bloom or watch how snowflakes can tease bare tree limbs into temporary blossoms of snow dissolving into diadems of sunlight. And what did Mike Tyson ever see besides brick walls and garbage in the gutter and disintegrating concrete steps and boarded up windows and broken car parts blocking the sidewalk and men bitter with their hands in their pockets and women bitter with their heads down and their eyes almost closed? In his neighborhood, where could you buy ribbons for a girl or tulips? Mike Tyson comes from Brooklyn, and so do I. In the big picture of America, I never had much going for me, and he had less. I only learned last year that I can stop whatever violence starts with me. I only learned last year that love is infinitely more interesting and more exciting and more powerful than really winning or really losing a fight. I only learned last year that all war leads to death and that all love leads you away from death. I am more than twice Mike Tyson's age, and I'm not stupid or slow, but I'm black, and I come from Brooklyn, and I grew up fighting, and I grew up and I got out of Brooklyn because I got pretty good at fighting and winning, or else intimidating my would-be adversaries with my fists, my feet, and my mouth. And I never wanted to fight. I never wanted anybody to hit me, and I never wanted to hit anybody. But the bell would ring at the end of another dumb day in school, and I'd head out with a dread and a nervous sweat because I knew some jackass, more or less my age and more or less my height, would be waiting for me because she or he had nothing better to do than to wait for me and hope to kick my butt or tear up my books or break my pencils or pull hair out of my head. This is the meaning of poverty, when you have nothing better to do than to hate somebody who, just exactly like yourself, has nothing better to do than to pick on you instead of trying to figure out how come there's nothing better to do. How come there's no gym, no swimming pool, no dirt track, no soccer field, no ice skating rink, no bike, no bike path, no tennis courts, no language arts workshop, no computer science center, no band practice, no choir rehearsal, no music lessons, no basketball or baseball team? How come neither one of you has his or her own room in a house where you can hang out and dance and make out or get on the telephone or eat and drink up everything in the kitchen that can move? How come nobody on your block and nobody in your class has any of these things? I'm black. Mike Tyson is black. And neither one of us was ever supposed to win anything more than a fight between the two of us. And if you check out the mass media material on us, and if you check out the emergency room reports on us, you might well believe we're losing the fight to be more than our enemies have decreed. Our enemies would deprive us of everything except each other. Hungry and furious and drug addicted and rejected and ever convinced we can never be beautiful or right or true or different from the beggarly monsters our enemies envision and insist upon. And how should we then stand, black man and black woman, face to face? Way back when I was born, Richard Wright had just published Native Son and thereby introduced white America to the monstrous product of its racist hatred. Poverty does not beatify. Poverty does not teach generosity or allow for sucker attributes of tenderness and restraint. In white America, hatred of black folks has imposed horrible poverty upon us. And so, back in the 30s, Richard Wright's Native Son, Bigger Thomas, did what he thought he had to do. He hideously murdered a white woman, and he viciously murdered his black girlfriend in what he conceived of as self-defense. He did not perceive any options to these psychopathic, horrifying deeds. I do not believe he, Bigger Thomas, had any other choices open to him. Not to him, he who was meant to die like the rat he, Bigger Thomas, cornered and smashed to death in his mother's beggarly clean space. I never thought Bigger Thomas was okay. I never thought he should skate back into my or anyone's community. But I did, and I do think he is my brother. The choices available to us dehumanize. And any single one of us, black in this white country, we may be defeated. We may become dehumanized by the monstrous hatred arrayed against us and our needy dreams. And so I write this requiem for Mike Tyson, international celebrity, millionaire, former heavyweight boxing champion of the world, a big-time winner, a big-time loser, an African-American male in his 20s, and now a convicted rapist. Do I believe he is guilty of rape? Yes, I do. And what would I propose as appropriate punishment? Whatever will force him to fear the justice of exact retribution, and whatever will force him for the rest of his damned life to regret and to detest the fact that he defiled, he subjugated, and he wounded somebody helpless to his power. And do I therefore rejoice in the jury's finding? I do not. Well, would I like to see Mike Tyson a free man again? He was never free. And I do not excuse or condone or forget or minimize or forgive the crime of his violation of the young black woman he raped. But did anybody ever tell Mike Tyson that you talk different to a girl? Where would he learn that? Would he learn that from United States Senator Ted Kennedy? Or from hotshot, scot-free movie director Roman Polanski? Or from rap recording star Ice Cube? Or from Ronald Reagan and the Grenada Escapade? or from George Bush in Panama, or from George Bush and Colin Powell in the Persian Gulf, or from the military hero flyboys who returned from bombing the shit out of civilian cities in Iraq and then said laughing and proud on international TV, "All I need now is a woman." Or from the hundreds of thousands of American football fans, or from the millions of Americans who would, if they could, pay surrealistic amounts of money just to witness up close somebody like Mike Tyson beat the brains out of somebody? And what could which university teach Mike Tyson about the difference between violence and love? Is there any citadel of higher education in the country that does not pay its football coach at least 3 times as much as the chancellor and 6 times as much as its professors and 10 times as much as its social and psychological counselors? In this America, where Mike Tyson and I live together and bitterly, bitterly apart, I say he became what he felt. He felt the stigma of a priori hatred and intentional poverty. He was given the choice of violence or violence, the violence of defeat or the violence of victory. Who would pay him to rehabilitate inner city housing or to refurbish a bridge? Who would pay him what to study the facts of our collective history? Who would pay him what to plant and nurture the trees of a forest? And who will write and who will play the songs that tell a guy like Mike Tyson how to talk to a girl? What was America willing to love about Mike Tyson, or any black man, or any man's man? Tyson's neighborhood and my own have become the same no-win battleground, and he has fallen there, and I do not rejoice. I do not.
Listening to part one of Good Fences Make Good Neighbors, or do they? The poem Affirmation, written by Asada Shakur, was read by Samantha Rogers and Lujain Asale. Music by Jamie Branch, Otis Brown, Mike Reed's People, Places, and Things, the Tamika Reed Quartet, Nicole Mitchell's Black Earth Ensemble, and Erwin Helfer. The excerpt from A Raisin in the Sun was written by Lorraine Hansberry. June Jordan read her essay, Requiem for the Champ, published in her book Technical Difficulties, recorded in Berkeley, California in 1992. We want to thank Gion Foreman, Natalie Moore, and Tanika Johnson for their willingness to be part of this program. Find out more about our guests at emeraldsouth.org, natalieymoore.com, and tanikaj.com. This show was produced by Mary Salome and Emily Charles, a Queer in Your Ear production.